Hi, I'm Steve Goldstein, and this is the Friday Newscap podcast. Each week, we review the biggest stories with experts, reporters, and commentators to put the news in perspective. Here's this week's episode.
Well, if we move a 20% pay raise to the teachers and there is this ongoing strike, that doesn't make sense. I mean, we're supposed to be here for the kids inside the classrooms. We've got these parents that are working and are going to be in a real jam in terms of what are they going to do with their kids. We've got many of these kids that get breakfast or lunch at the school. We've got graduations coming up.
It was actually a very painful decision because nobody wants to leave the children and nobody wants to close the school. But the action wasn't happening, and we heard one promise and then no concrete follow-up. So it wasn't just about teacher salaries. It was also about how we were going to continue to fund the school.
All I can say is, wow, this is really something. I'm going to be a congresswoman.
We have 36 days for our next petition to be in with all of our signatures. So don't be surprised if I come knocking on your door anytime soon for that.
And with us to talk about Arizona teachers walking out and marching to the Capitol and the results of the special congressional election, our longtime pollster and host of the think tank, Mike O'Neill, and John Gabriel, editor-in-chief of Ricochet. Guys, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Morning.
All right, John, let's start off with what you have commented on related to the teacher walkout, the teacher strike, whatever we're calling it. You think there's a real risk here for teachers to lose the public goodwill?
Right. And it's a big part of it is just the optics of the situation, because the easiest battle to win is a bunch of teachers who are underpaid to start with fighting against out-of-touch politicians who are talking about numbers and their green eye shade calculations. Now it's turning into teachers versus parents, teachers versus students, and that's a much more difficult battle to win. And parents in general have supported Red for Ed pretty significantly, and you could just see it driving around town with Red for Ed written on the back of car windows as I'm dropping off my kids to school. But at this point, it's they're in danger of losing the public.
At what point, though? So we're in day two. If this were to end on Monday and there's some reasonable movement toward it, I mean, what's your timeline, I guess?
I think if they go through the end of the week, there's going to be polling that should change pretty significantly, I would think. A couple days off isn't going to be a big deal. People will forget about it in a week. But what you really need is the parental support on this issue. They're the taxpayers.
Mike?
I agree. It is certainly a very high-stakes, risky gamble on the part of the educators. I'm not 100% convinced. I think this could go either way. I think it depends on the posturing. I think, Governor Ducey sent everybody into whiplash because one day he says 1% maximum. The next day he says 20%. Where the teacher's problem is that even though their demands were bigger than the 20%, not for more money, but for other things, sustainable funding, the public perception was that what they were asking for was a 20% raise, and the optics are that he gave them that. Now, I think really what this comes down to is an issue of trust, and they don't trust him because Governor Ducey has been on the other side of the issue all along, arguing even, for example, that the mandated funds by vote of the people, well, we'll get you to settle for 70% of the dollar. And then they did that, and they didn't fund that with new money. They raided a trust fund, which turned out to be illegal, may have to be paid back. So what they're arguing now is we're not arguing over the 20%. We're arguing, have you done this in a way that's sustainable? And it's not clear at all that 20% is credible. But I think the public support at this point is very much up for grabs. It is a high-stakes gamble.
But if we're talking about the optics of this, the image, the visual of the walk yesterday was just massive. I mean, it looked outrageous. It was like the sea of red. It took all of Washington and went on and on. Do you think that helped?
Absolutely. Yeah. When I saw that picture, I was absolutely, I expected a little crowd around the Capitol.
Yeah.
That filled the street all the way from City Hall to the state capitol. It was impressive. Mm-hmm. The problem is, now what's the next act? That's the hard part.
John, what are your thoughts on that? Because I do wonder, especially if this comes out, and I don't know if people really expect lawmakers to make a major action on this, but let's say there's a combination of this. Let's say there is because we don't know how much money there is in the kitty. Let's say a 9% raise first year gets passed, and then a ballot initiative gets kicked to voters. Does a combination like that potentially work?
I think it would. And I think, again, everybody in politics talks about optics all the time, but winning kind of the PR battle, it is important. I think teachers need to be seen to be willing to compromise about these things. And I think that is something that could be a win-win. And I think most voters are looking for a win-win.
The other aspect of optics, however, was 50,000 citizens are marching on the legislature. What did the legislature do? They adjourned and went home for the weekend. I think that was a very bad move.
Well, and what about there are always distractions. And in the old days, some people would call them crazy bills at the legislature in order to, the session would keep going. When is the budget going to get settled? Mike, in this situation, when we're talking about attacking Noah Carvelis, for example, one of the leaders of Red for Ed. And in some ways, he's a kind of an easy target. But is that a sign that lawmakers aren't taking this seriously enough? Okay, it's okay to pick on this guy, but are you actually going to get something done?
Yeah, I think what people are looking for is, what do you do with the budget? How do you make the 20% figure, you know, it was really 9% this year, because no legislature can bind future legislators. So it's 9%, which would probably be enough for the teachers. How can you make that credible and sustainable? And what the teachers are looking at is, well, you got a budget surplus this year, and then you're raiding some funds from some other places. No guarantee that any of those are going to be around. And, you know, 9 months from now, they won't have an election hanging over their heads, and they're afraid that this all goes away at that point. There's no leverage left.
John, jump in on this, what I said, though, as far as what it comes down to. Do we have to see these kinds of distractions? Is that just human nature, or can lawmakers focus and not worry about who's leading the Red for Ed movement?
Arizona lawmakers, as has been said before, leaving during the middle of that march was just insane, but that's what we're used to with the legislature, unfortunately, in this state. I don't care which party controls it. It's always kind of a mess trying to make sense of that, and the oddest voices are the ones that are the loudest often.
One of the things, so I spoke with Representative Paul Boyer this morning, chair of the Education Committee, and he seemed to think, he said he met with 30 teachers yesterday. I think the other side did as well. He seemed to think, though, that it was sort of a misunderstanding, especially, he said, with the union leader organizers here, which goes to this attacking the people who are in charge of this. But he seemed to think, like, they didn't understand the way this process works and the way that it might pan out. What do you think about that?
You know, I think everybody's avoiding the real issue. The real issue here is that Governor Ducey and the Republicans are willing to do anything as long as it doesn't involve raising a nickel in taxes. And the teachers are looking at that and saying, there's no way to do this on a sustainable basis. This is real money. You've cut the budget. You've cut taxes over and over and over. There's no money left. If you're not willing to put more money on the table, nothing is going to be real.
John, does it feel too political in this sense? This feels like a grassroots movement to many people. And of course, that means people are going to jump on board. And so then people are easily accused of getting involved or saying, well, see, look, they're being driven just by politics. But based on what Mike just said there, are we in a situation where something can actually legitimately get done, again, without these distractions that I keep bringing up? I wonder, we come back to optics, we come back to this, but the trust issue as well, do you see a way that this actually happens in the next couple of days in a way that is sustainable and satisfying, at least for the short term?
I think there could be, if we're looking instead of the next day or two, looking at the next week, I think there definitely is. What you need to do is have lawmakers being responsible about these things and being willing to think outside the box and find out, like a voter initiative hitting the ballot in November. You know, that could be something, but there needs to be give and take on both sides.
But is Governor Ducey's plan dead at this point? Or the Republicans seem to think that that's what they're going to focus on passing, but Democrats have not said that.
Well, the teachers have said they're not buying anything that's in smoke and mirrors and just taking existing one-time funds. I think the Republic said this as well. The way out of this, you've got the legislature and the governor who said, I will never raise taxes. You've got the teachers who are saying, we're not going to believe anything if it doesn't involve new taxes. I think if there is going to be a compromise, it's pretty clear what it is. It's you kick an initiative to the voters and let the voters be the one who impose the taxes. And then if the voters say no, the teachers are out of luck. If the voters say yes, which I think they will, then the Ducey and the legislature can say, well, we didn't do it.
Well, that's where John's point about goodwill really comes in. Mm-hmm. Because if this goes on for a short period of time and teachers make their point and actually get lawmakers to do, again, something for the next fiscal year and then kick this measure to the ballot, that's where, John, I think your timing comes in. Because if this lasts a few days, then maybe that goodwill is still going to be there. How much does that play into your timing?
I think it's very important that they get on this very quick. And that's why it was so frustrating to see the legislature walk out yesterday. It's just insane that they would be doing that while teachers are walking towards the Capitol. They're running away, basically. So victory for the teachers there. But it has to happen quickly. And it's one of these things, if this is all resolved by the end of next week, most voters aren't going to remember this in November, whatever is on the ballot. And education measures usually pass for the most part. So I think they would have a strong claim. They're already organized. They could definitely get out the vote for that.
Mike, final thoughts on this?
All right. I think, you know, we just put together the package. The package the package is you get Ducey's deal for this year coupled with a referral by the legislature to a vote of the people for probably a 1% sales tax hike in addition to the renewal that they already did, and let the people be responsible for their own level of taxes.
And we'll talk about later in the program Doug Ducey getting a challenge from someone. But ultimately, if that happens, Doug Ducey emerges as a victor of sorts, even
yes.
if for short term he was not.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is the one. I think he's terrified of this whole issue. It is the one thing that could sink him if he plays it poorly. I think that would be a solution that would allow him to weasel out of this. That he'd have some problem on the right of his own party, but he could live with that.
Now, John, I'm not sure you'd agree with the verb that Mike used there, but as far as the rest of it, what do you think?
I encourage him to compromise with people. I think he would come out as a deal maker and a problem solver, and that's really what he has based much of his brand on, getting in there, look at the opioid epidemic funding. It's something, I'm going to go in there, I'm going to sit everybody down and work out a deal.
That's John Gabriel. Also here is Mike O'Neill. I'm Steve Goldstein. Along with Lauren Gilger, you're listening to the NewsCap here on KJZZ's The Show. More to come after this. This is KJZZ's The Show. We're in the midst of the Friday NewsCap along with Mike O'Neill and John Gabriel. I'm Steve Goldstein with Lauren Gilger.
And we want to start talking this segment about the CD8 election, Debbie Lesko beating Carol Tipernenny in the 8th District, but not by as much as many thought she might. What are the political ramifications there? You want to start us off, John?
Yeah, I think looking at this from a Washington, D.C. perspective, I think they're looking at their check engine light has been flashing nonstop for the past year. They should be very worried about the midterms. And even with that, I don't think they hold the House through the midterms. For Debbie Lesko to kind of eke out a victory here, that's obvious. That's expected. She's replacing Trent Franks, one of the most conservative people in a very conservative state. And you have the situation now, and I think the teachers' protests and things helped her opponent quite a bit, but it's just looking very bad for the GOP come November.
Yeah, Mike, it's we're told there are no moral victories in sports or politics. I guess in this case, though, for the Democrats, this is a moral victory.
Obviously, Debbie Lesko won. That's a, quote, victory. But this is not supposed to be a race that's even even contested. Normally, this race, nobody runs or nobody serious runs. Mm-hmm. I have in front of me a list of all of the special elections that have been held since the 2016 election. The Democrats have outperformed on average by 15 points. This election was right on the mark. It was a 21% Donald Trump district. The victory margin in this ended up being slightly less than 5%. That is absolutely dead on the mark, and that is horrible news for Republicans. And if you want to talk about Arizona politics, I wouldn't look so much as to this in November as I would look to things like Congressman Schweikert, who is in a plus 10% Republican district, which is normally a completely safe district. If Democrats continue to outperform by 15%, I think some people are going to take a look at that one who haven't looked at it before and say, all of a sudden, a district like this could be in play.
Yeah. I wonder also the other kind of stats that came out of this, the 5% victory, but then the turnout was really low. I think it was around 38%. What do you think that says about?
That's just, a high for a special election.
For a special
election. An incredibly high turnout.
Right. But that still left a lot of Republicans sitting at home, right?
Well, and Democrats, too. I think here's the usual thing in off-season elections. The normal thing is that Republicans turn out greater than Democrats do. That's why Republicans generally do better in off-year elections. I think there's two things that mitigate that in this time. One is obviously the enthusiasm gap. But number two, there's been one fundamental change underlying the way the electorate behaves, and that is for the first time in 2016, more educated voters tended to be Democrat. That is and highly educated voters are the ones most likely to vote. That, I think, has driven the fact that Republicans have always done better in turnout. That may be about to flip.
Now, John, David Schweigert has been mentioned before. That one seems incredibly far-fetched, and yet Mike is right about the numbers. Is Schweigert someone who should be a bit worried? Because I don't know that we've heard anything about his potential Democratic opponent.
Yeah, it really depends on who they get for an opponent. But if you're the National Democratic Party, you should be looking at a strong person. There's plenty of candidates out there who could take him on. And many of his constituents are the exact type of people who might be likely to vote Republican most years, but they see Donald Trump as the avatar of the party and go, eh, it's a bit too far.
But highly educated, right. Republican, suburban
right.
voters.
But exactly. How many of those people, Mike, voted for Trump himself? Must have been a number of them, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't, you know, in that district, I don't, but that is a district that is probably more well suited. I mean, the Debbie Lesko district was heavily retirees. Those are the last people going to budge. But more middle-aged, highly educated, suburban voters are a Democratic target this year around.
One thing I don't think has come up a lot in the conversation about this election is Trent Franks and the way that he left office. And I wonder, do you think that played into this? Do you think voters were thinking about that at all when they were going into this? It was two women running.
Yeah, I think so. It was very wise of both parties to ended up nominating women to run for that role. It's kind of weird how little that Trent Franks situation has been covered.
Yeah.
After the news broke, everybody was shocked, and then it just kind of disappeared. I think it might be a dissatisfaction with incumbents in general, but we've seen it affecting the major party in Arizona being Arizona. You've seen Don Shooter and all these things in the state legislature as well, which just looks really bad, really out of touch. I think in general you're going to see a lot more female candidates.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think that Trent Franks was a factor other than in making the seat available.
It may have been a factor in terms of the primary where Steve Montenegro couldn't really get traction and sort of cleared the way for
Debbie. His endorsement. Yeah, that's a good point. In the primary, he was a non-factor there too, but he could have been a factor in under normal circumstances. His endorsement would have meant something. It meant nothing.
John, another question related to what Mike's talking about with these trends and whatnot. So when it comes down to Arizona, let's look at the Senate race. We're going to likely have two women facing off, whether it is Martha McSally for the Republicans or Kelly Ward. I think we can safely say Sheriff Arpaio is not going to be winning that particular race. And we saw some polls this week that indicate a pretty healthy advantage for Kyrsten Sinema. Mm-hmm. Is that a race that Republicans at some point are going to say, maybe we should invest somewhere else? Or because if it's McSally versus Sinema, I mean, how do you see that playing out? Not even in terms of who wins, but in terms of how much investment there is if Republicans have to protect other seats.
Yeah, I think the Senate is going to be less important. It's tougher for Democrats to win the majority in the Senate. So I think they're going to be blowing a lot of money, the GOP, on the House, which probably isn't a wise investment at this point. We have to see how the polling plays out. But Kyrsten Sinema, throughout her career, has been a person who can really win over, at least on a personal level, the other side. She happens to be my congresswoman right now. And she's not this bomb-throwing radical out there. She works with people. Every mailer I get, I'm a veteran, and every mailer I get talks about supporting the military. And, you know, so she... She does not look scary to someone, even if they voted for Republicans most of their life. She looks like, oh, okay, it seems like she's doing a good job.
Mike, what are you seeing this
in the last week or two? I think there's been other develops elsewhere in the country that I think increasingly put the Senate in play. It was an extremely tortuous role for Democrats. They had to keep 10 seats that are held by Democrats in Donald Trump's won states, and they had to win Nevada and Arizona, and they had no margin for error. The change is Tennessee. Latest polling in Tennessee shows a dead heat, and that would be a net gain of one. That would give, if the Democrats were to win that one, that would allow them to lose one somewhere else. So the Senate, I mean, the movement is all in the Democratic direction, even the last week or two. So even the Senate may be in play.
So if we're looking at a Democratic wave, which you seem to think we are, is this about Trump? And in what ways is this about Trump here in Arizona in particular?
I think it's about Donald Trump everywhere. I mean, if we could go back to generic Republican and generic Democrat, I think that we wouldn't be talking about either house flipping. This is, and the Republicans are in a horrible strait. There's this disaffection with Donald Trump, but almost every single incumbent Republican is scared to death about Donald Trump turning out his voters against them in the primary. And so they are, on the one hand, unwilling to say anything bad about Donald Trump because Donald Trump will go for him. And on the other hand, that becomes an albatross that they have to live with in November.
And I think another problem, too, is you have complete Republican domination of D.C., and not a lot has gotten done. You know, you had the big tax cut, which even some budget hawks have said, we got to cut spending instead. Looking at the national debt, just continuing to jump the deficit year by year, jumping under Trump. And the party as a whole has been very ineffectual. And then you just have voter fatigue with Donald Trump, you know, every day. Oh, my gosh, he did a tweet, and that's all we talk about for the next 3 hours until he says something else kind of incendiary. So will voters just finally be exhausted with it all and just want to hear other voices? I think that's a key, a very tough key to measure, though.
Gentlemen, down to our final 90 seconds or so. Mike, let me ask you about this challenge that Governor Ducey has. No, not from the teachers, but from a fellow Republican who lost to him 4 years ago, Ken Bennett. There have been some critics of Ken Bennett who say, it wouldn't be an election cycle without Ken Bennett running for something. But what do you make of that? I mean, he was a respected Senate president. He was Secretary of State. And now he's running for governor against an incumbent who they seem to have the same constituency.
I didn't get it, frankly. I listened to his statement, and I couldn't figure out what the basis of his. I mean, it reminded me of that old interview in 1980 with Ted Kennedy, where they asked him, why are you running for president? He rambled for 5 minutes. And at the end of it, you concluded he really hasn't thought about this. He doesn't have a clear reason for running.
John,
yeah, it really doesn't make any sense at all, other than he just wants to make sure he visits every county in the state during the peak of summer. I don't really understand why he's running, but Mazel Tov, good luck.
Well, I mean, does he make any kind of a dent? Does none. Governor Ducey talk to him? I mean, is there?
Yeah, none whatsoever. As you mentioned, they really kind of have the same constituency, kind of responsible, businesslike, workaday Republican. And he doesn't make a compelling case why Ducey has to go and he should replace him.
Mike, in 30 seconds, explain the hubris of politicians. What is it?
Can I have 30 minutes?
I mean, I guess a friend told him he should run or something, right?
I honestly don't know. You know, maybe he's bored. I don't get it. I agree with John. I don't see the basis where you pull together a constituency. I mean, if he were to come out and say on one side or the other of Ducey, then maybe he could make a case, you know, either yes or no. I mean, you could see him, but he's more or less threading the difference in the middle. So he's not sufficiently distinct from Ducey to make a case.
That's Mike O'Neill, longtime pollster, host of The Think Tank, and John Gabriel, editor-in-chief of Ricochet. Guys, thanks for being here.
You bet.
You've been listening to the Friday Newscap from KJZZ's The Show. It's an original podcast recapping the week's big stories with experts, commentators, and reporters. You can get the full show podcast at podcast.kjzz.org. If you have any questions or comments, please email us at theshow@kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. And thanks for listening.